What are we willing to say that we don't know? I mean, that's a huge issue. How do you all feel about end times right now? I mean, is it obviously with the Israeli conflict with Hezbollah and Hamas and what's going on there, it's sparking a lot of new interest. Well, it's not, I wouldn't say it's new, but it's certainly ratcheting up the interest to a new level. And we're seeing a lot more speculation about end times, connecting end times prophecies to the headlines and trying to make those kind of one-to-one connections. Well, that's what we want to talk about this morning. In fact, what I want to try to do is to first just kind of lay out what we know about prophecy. I try to give you both sides now, both sides of the story, and give you as much information as you can, not trying to prove one thing or another or not trying to convince you of anything, but just to lay some things out so that you can make your own decision about what part prophecy plays in our lives today and how we should responsibly use it in terms of our day-to-day lives. What attitude should we have about the times that we live in and what we see is coming down the pike? First of all, the reason that this conflict in Israel is of such interest to end times folks is because of the basic scenario that the shape of end times prophecy is typically interpreted to be in evangelical circles. Someone mentioned just a minute ago that every generation has thought that Jesus was coming back in their lifetime, and to a certain extent that's true. Especially the first generation after Yeshua died seems to have believed, Paul's writings seem to indicate that he expected Jesus to come back in his lifetime. And there were preparations and there were ways that they were living with that sort of expectation. He didn't come. Things had to be retooled. There's even stories that people waited on the hill of the Ascension, expecting him to come back any day now. And then eventually filtered off as that time went on. Around the year 1000, people were freaking out at the millennium, thinking, okay, this is the time, this is a significant number, the world is going to end now, and the Lord is coming back. And that didn't happen. At the year 2000, we had sort of the same thing with the millennium bug in the computers and all the sort of thing going on. In the 1800s, in this country, there were many groups that were apocalyptic groups that believed and set a date for the end of the year. One of the biggest ones were the Millerites. I don't even know if you've ever heard of this group. But the Great Disappointment in capitals is what happened when the Miller who set the date, which didn't come, and had gathered thousands of people around his ministry and around his predictions, were very disappointed, if you can imagine that. When the world didn't end, yeah, it was called the Great Disappointment. But there are many groups. The Jehovah's Witnesses were another group that came out of the 1800s that set a date, not so much a physical date, but at least when they reached the 144,000 number, as is relayed in Revelation, they thought the end time sequence was going to kick off. And that didn't happen. So then they had to spiritualize that understanding and move on. World War II was another time that end times theorists saw the Antichrist and Hitler and saw the end times events starting to take place. All of these times throughout the last 2,000 years have had a flaw in them, though, in that the end times prophecies seem to indicate that Israel would be existing as a nation and the temple would be rebuilt. Well, Israel did not exist as a nation until 1948, after World War II, when it was officially designated and land was allotted and the Jews were allowed to come back. And so now, since 1948, end times theorists have really been paying attention, because now there is a nation of Israel. There is no temple. And things don't look very bright for the building of a temple right now, since Jerusalem and the Temple Mount are divided between Arabs and Jews. And so it's very difficult. In fact, some reports I've heard is that Jews don't even want to rebuild the temple, or a lot of the rank-and-file Jews don't want to, because it's going to cause too much trouble and too much strife between them and the Arabs. So it's like, forget about it. We don't need it. Plus, Israel is a fairly secular nation right now. There's the Orthodox who really want to rebuild the temple, but they're a small radical group within the overall population. And so things don't look really bright for the rebuilding of a temple, but the book of Revelation indicates that there will be a temple rebuilt. How is this all going to take place, and why are these end-time theorists so interested in the conflict in Israel? In Ezekiel 38, there is a battle that is predicted that from the ancient names of the combatants involved, it looks as though it's going to be some sort of coalition between Russia and northern Iraq and possibly some Arab nations that are going to invade Israel. And that battle is sometimes made identical with the Battle of Armageddon, but mostly it's separated as having to be two separate battles. Not only that, this battle looks like it has to happen prior to the rest of the end time sequence. So I'm going to give you the scenario of the end time sequence based on the usual model that Tim LaHaye of the Left Behind series and Hal Lindsey, the Calvary Chapel model, that basic model that most of the conservative evangelical churches are using in this country, theorize. The reason they're interested in Israel right now is it looks like that coalition is forming. You've got Hamas and you've got Hezbollah, two terrorist organizations in Palestine and in Lebanon that are funded both by Syria and by Iran. So there's this axis of powers that are kind of developing against Israel. Obviously, the entire Arab world has been dedicated to the destruction of Israel since its inception in 48. But now you've got also some intelligence groups saying that behind Iran stands Russia. And Russia is interested in Iranian oil, of course. They are having economic and political problems of their own, and so they're looking for any sort of axis that can help them out. So basically, you have sort of the major players lined up right now against Israel. The idea is in Ezekiel 38 that these powers are finally going to coalesce and physically invade Israel to try to take it out. But they are going to be defeated in what they would assume is going to be a nuclear exchange. The imagery in Ezekiel, whether it's 2nd century B.C. or 5th century B.C., depending on where you want to date the book of Ezekiel, they're saying, okay, people looking at a nuclear exchange and a vision from God, not understanding the technology behind it, would use such imagery. There's imagery of the dead being left and marked by people in special suits. There's all kinds of strange imagery that looks like it could be the aftermath of a nuclear exchange, where these armies are basically wiped out and Israel is left standing. But if you can imagine the political, economic turmoil of such a nuclear exchange in the Middle East, you can understand that the globe would be affected. Oil would be disrupted. It would be an absolute mess. Out of this chaos is going to come a leader who will be able to broker a peace agreement between the rest of the powers that be and Israel and sort of reset the table. And this leader is going to be revered worldwide for his ability to be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again to a certain extent. This person is who is called the Antichrist. This event will kick off the 7-year tribulation, which is called the 70th week of Daniel, which is prophesied in the book of Daniel. Remember, we have a situation in Israel right now where the rebuilding of the temple is not likely. But after a situation like this, where now there are no Arabs in Israel anymore, Israel is free politically to control the Temple Mount. Plus, you would assume that maybe the secular attitude in Israel would change at this point and be looking a lot more toward God in a theocratic sort of way. So the whole temperature would change in Israel. And now they would have the permission also, through this brokered treaty and peace agreement, to be able to rebuild the temple at this time. And so the temple rebuilding starts to take place in this 7-year period, the 70th week of Daniel. The 70th week or the 7-year period is usually divided into two halves, a first 3.5 years and a second 3.5 years. Within the first 3.5 years, some of the seals of wrath that Revelation talks about will be opened. So there'll be famines and pestilences and some problems. But relatively, it'll be a time of peace. This sort of Pax Romana type of brokered peace would be established in these first 3.5 years, and the temple would be rebuilt. But in the middle of that, the Antichrist shows his true colors. He breaks the treaty with Israel. He takes over Israel. He apparently sets up some sort of idol in the Holy of Holies of the temple, and all sorts of things kick off in that midpoint of those 7 years, including two witnesses that are speculated to possibly be Moses and Elijah, who are witnesses that come and are preaching what is going on. There is also a one-world government that is set up at this time. So basically this leader is able to coalesce all the rulers under one heading. There is a one-world religion. There is a religious leader who is attached to the political leader that some speculate to be the Pope of Rome, of the Roman Catholic Church, that they will somehow coalesce this whole government and religion into one global entity. And that kicks off the second 3.5 years. This is where it really gets nasty. This is where up to a third of the world's population is killed through these various opening of the remaining seven seals and the trumpets and all this imagery, where all these horrible things are happening. Anything that looks like either nuclear exchanges or asteroids hitting the Earth, we just don't know. But there's images of fiery mountains falling into the sea and a third of the plants and trees and green things being burned up, and a third of the sea animals being killed, and a third of the people is being killed. Anyway, it just goes through this horrible scenario up to the end of the 7 years, when there is a global conflict, which is known as Armageddon, where all the nations of the earth, this is one reason that most of these theorists and interpreters feel that the first battle is not Armageddon, because it lists the combatants. And then Armageddon, it lists them as all the nations of the earth will fight. And during this battle, Christ will actually return and direct the battle in his favor, in God's favor, set up the millennium, the 1,000-year reign of a golden age on earth, where it really is something like a pure theocracy, with Christ either physically or spiritually at the head, and where the Antichrist and Satan and all his minions are thrown into the abyss and locked away for this 1,000-year period, at the end of which they will be loosed one more time. There will be one final brief battle, and then they will be permanently banished. The new Jerusalem will descend, and the earth will basically be rolled up like a scroll, and a new heaven and earth will take place. So that's kind of the general flow of it. The one key part that I didn't mention, because it can happen so many different places within the scenario, is the idea of the rapture. The rapture is the idea from a Latin word that means to snatch up, that the church cannot be present during all or most of these events because the church is separate in dispensational thinking. And I'll have to define that in a second. But in dispensational thinking, which is really necessary if you're going to believe this whole scenario, the church and Israel have to be separate. The promises that are made to Israel all throughout Scripture cannot simultaneously apply to the church. And so it is believed that the church has to be taken out before a lot of these things can happen. That taking away of the church, that you're all probably familiar with the Left Behind series and everything, where people are basically kind of either lifted up kind of in a levitational way and ascend or disappear, or however that works, can happen either before the whole 70th week of Daniel occurs, in the middle, or at the end. So some people believe that the church will have to go through that whole 7-year period of horribleness. Some people believe, well, no, we're only going to go through the first half, which is relatively peaceful. And others believe, no, we have to be taken out before any of it can happen. So we're going to be spared all of that. Some people believe the rapture has to happen before the battle, the invasion of Israel, that first battle. And some say, no, it'll happen after that battle, but before. And so you kind of get the picture. All of these scenarios are part of what people are trying to interpret out of the passage. First of all, is this the only way that the church looks at end times prophecy? The answer would be absolutely not. Although we, as conservative evangelicals in the United States, it seems like this is the prevalent view among Christians. But actually, it's a minority view. Even within the Protestant branch of Christianity, there's three branches: Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, and Protestantism. Even within Protestantism, it's a minority view. It exists within the conservative evangelical branch, I guess, of which we are a part. So within that bubble, it seems like it's everything. But mainstream Protestant churches don't hold to this view. Certainly Catholics don't hold to this view, and Eastern Orthodox peoples don't hold to this view. So it is a minority view, and it really is more prevalent in the United States than anywhere else in the world. It's kind of a phenomenon that has occurred here in this country starting in the 1830s. You can tell that this isn't the only way to look at end times prophecy because of all the labels that you have to give it to define what it is. First of all, you have to say that this view is dispensational, it's futurist, it's premillennial, and it's pre-tribulation. Okay, those are the four things that you need to know. Dispensationalism, I don't want to spend a lot of time on, but it is a theological theory that God works differently and has a different relational setup at different times in history. So from the creation and to the fall would be one dispensation, where God is working with humanity and Adam and Eve in one way. From the fall to the covenant with Abraham or Moses would be another dispensation. From Moses until the cross would be another dispensation. From the cross to the end times would be another dispensation. Anyway, each of these dispensations, and there's usually seven of them, would be a different type of relationship with God. Primarily before and after the cross, God deals differently with humanity. You've heard that before. The dispensational view is what makes this end times scenario that we just talked about possible because it separates Israel from the church. The competing theology would be covenant theology, where God deals in different covenants. But these covenants equate the church and Israel become one. It's also called replacement theology, where the church replaces Israel. Since Israel didn't see Jesus as their Savior, the church is now spiritual Israel. Equates the two. You can't have the same type of end times interpretation if the church and Israel are the same thing for a lot of complicated reasons that I'm not going to get into. But anyway, just know that dispensationalism, the idea of dispensationalism, is a prerequisite to everything else we're going to talk about. Now, premillennial, what does that mean? That means the time at which you think Jesus is going to return the second time, the first time he came in the first century in Palestine. Is he going to come before the millennium? That would be premillennium. In other words, Jesus comes and establishes millennium. Is he going to come after the millennium, post-millennium? Is there no millennium at all? That would be amillennialism. So there's three different views, pre, post, and amillennialism. What's the difference between the two? Well, if Jesus comes before the millennium, that means that human history is going to continue to degrade and get worse and worse and worse, and that we are basically helpless to turn it around, so that Jesus has to physically come back. God has to physically intervene in order to make it better and to create the millennium. If you're a post-millennialist, then what you're really saying is that humankind is going to get better. It's eventually going to turn around and get better. We are going to become more enlightened. We're going to be able to create the millennium on earth through God's Spirit, but without any direct intervention. And Jesus is going to basically come back at the end of all that and take control over what we need to create ourselves. Think about the difference in mindset between those two. Human history is going to continue to get worse until God comes, or human history is going to evolve kind of in a Star Trek sort of way. You know, we're going to get better, and then God is going to come at the end. And then if you're an amillennialist, then you basically believe competition everywhere. If you're an amillennialist, you basically believe that this is the millennium. What the church age that we are living in right now is the millennium. And so there really is no specific end point in times where there is going to be a definable millennium, but that we're going to come through this period more like a post-millennialist, and we are going to create the society that God would want us to have. They wouldn't see the 1,000 years as being literal at all. In fact, most post-millennialists wouldn't see that as being a literal number either, whereas most premillennialists, who tend to take the Bible much more literally, would see it as an actual 1,000-year period. But the numbers can be symbolic or they can be literal. And especially, you have to understand, the whole genre of apocalyptic literature is such that it is highly symbolic and highly figurative. I guess, what are the books that are relevant here? Well, in the Old Testament, you have Ezekiel and Daniel, which are the primary two. In the New Testament, of course, you have Revelation. But you also have chapter 24 of Matthew and chapter 21 of Luke, which deal with these. You have sections in Thessalonians and Corinthians and Paul's writings. and scattered other passages throughout the New Testament that deal with these. All of these passages or books that are apocalyptic in literature have to be looked at differently than more historical books, say as like Kings and Chronicles, and the rest of the letters of the epistles of the New Testament, which can be taken much more historically and accurately as relating dates and numbers. But the apocalyptic literature, they are trying to get a spiritual point across through the symbolic use. Think of the number 12 in Revelation. The number 12 is used repeatedly, not necessarily as a literal number, but when the New Jerusalem comes out, it's 12 stadia on a side, and it's got 12 towers and 12 gates and 12 this and 12 that. Well, 12 was a symbolic number for all of mankind or government or foundation, all of those ideas. And so you can see how the number 12 is figuring heavily. The number 7 with the 7 seals, meaning a number of perfection or spiritual dimension or whatever, also figures very prominently. So yes, numbers are going to be used in a different way, especially in this genre of writing. The last term that we are talking about is pre-tribulation, which defines this evangelical point of view. That deals with when the rapture is going to occur. I told you it can occur at the beginning, it can occur at the end, or it can occur in the middle. So if you are a pre-tribulation rapturist, that means you believe the rapture will occur before the seven-year period. If you're a mid-trib rapturist, to be in the middle, and if you're a post-trib rapturist, at the end. There's also a new designation called a pre-wrath rapturist, which is somewhere around the middle, but before the wrath actually occurs in the second. So the designations are getting finer and finer and finer as people have more time to work on the scriptures and to try to interpret them. The interesting thing about the rapture is that there's a huge debate as to whether there even is going to be a rapture within the church. Arguably, and this is, those who believe in the rapture will argue this point, but I'd say most of the literature that I'm seeing out there credits the rapture to an Irish preacher, minister named by the name of John Darby in the 1830s. Who, if he didn't actually invent the idea of the rapture, at least was the one who popularized it. And I will say this, that any of the citations of the rapture prior to 1830 are sparse, and they're usually attributed to relatively unknown people. It's not like you see major fathers of the church talking about the rapture, writing about the rapture, or interpreting the rapture from Scripture, either in the formation times of the church or even through the Reformation time in the 16th century. But starting in 1830, the rapture becomes huge. And so whether it started with John Darby or not, there really is very little about this concept of the rapture. And it's pretty oblique, I will say this, before 1830. So it doesn't mean that John Darby just made it up necessarily. But it does mean that such a foundational principle as the rapture, it's surprising that there wasn't a lot more about it in the first 1700 years of the church's history. Primary one is in 1 Thessalonians, where Paul talks about being snatched up in a twinkling of an eye. It's from Matthew 24, and so Matthew 24 seems to have an allusion to it as well. But really, what kicked off the whole rapture idea was that John Darby was also the father of dispensationalism. So once you start looking at life and scriptures from a dispensational point of view, you realize again that the church and Israel cannot be one and the same. There has to be a separation between the two. And once they have to be separated, well, how do you get the church out of there? And so logically it sort of follows. And then you can reread Thessalonians and Matthew 24 and say, oh, well, of course the church is going to be taken out at some point. So, I'm not trying to tell you that the rapture is not going to occur. I want to give you enough information so that you can see that there is a real debate going on here. So, anyway, just so that you know that there really is a controversy over the rapture, and, boy, I didn't even talk about preterism yet. I better back up here. I missed one of the categories, which is a futurist point of view, which also describes what this evangelical point of view is. A futurist is someone who believes that all the events in Scripture are still to happen in the future and need to be taken literally and not allegorically or symbolically. As opposed to a preterist who believes that all of the events in Scripture have already been fulfilled. In other words, the prophets who wrote the apocalyptic books were predicting events that were going to happen shortly to the nation of Israel in particular, and they have already happened. There are three seminal events in Jewish history from the time of the return from the exile until the nation is finally obliterated by the Romans. And that is the Maccabean Revolt that happened began in 167 BCE. You have the Jewish Wars that began in 66 and ended in 73 AD, and that's where Jerusalem was destroyed and the temple was destroyed. And then you finally have the Bar Kokhba Revolt, which began in 132, I believe, and lasted until 135. And there was a very, very brief 2 or 3 year period where there was actually a state set up by Bar Kokhba, and then the Romans came in and obliterated them. So if you take those three events, 2nd century BC, 1st century, 2nd century AD, and you look at where the prophetic books line up, you've got Ezekiel and Daniel that happened prior to the Maccabean Revolt in the 2nd century. Now, how soon before depends on where you date the book. Conservative scholars always date the books earlier, and liberal scholars always date the books later. Why? Because of prophetic literature. Liberal scholars tend to minimize prophecy or deny it or reject it altogether, and so they're going to late date the books after the events that they're talking about. Since Daniel talks a lot about the succession of kingdoms that rule over Judea, from the Persians and Babylonians to the Greeks and the Romans, they late date Daniel into the 2nd century, but prior to the Maccabean Revolt. So all of the imagery to a preterist in Daniel and Ezekiel is relating to the events that take place in the Maccabean Revolt. The man of lawlessness, or the abomination and the desecration of the temple, all took place with Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the Seleucid Greek ruler at the time, who actually did desecrate the temple, took it over. There's reports that he slaughtered a pig on the altar and put a statue of one of the Greek gods in the Holy of Holies, which is what kicked off the Maccabean Revolt. He also outlawed circumcision and did everything he could to try to stamp out Judaism as identifiable religion and race. So the books of Daniel and Ezekiel were predicting that event and nothing further. When you look at Matthew 24, Luke 21, and you see the imagery that Jesus uses, he is, to a preterist, predicting the Jewish wars of 67 to 73, and the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. And depending on where you're going to date Revelation, if you're going to date Revelation early and prior to 70, then Revelation is also predicting that event. Most scholars, though, put Revelation later, at around the turn of the first century. But then it would be predicting the second Jewish revolt, which resulted in the complete annihilation of Judea as any sort of Jewish entity. The Emperor Hadrian, who put down the Bar Kokhba Revolt, basically razed Jerusalem to the ground, sowed the soil with salt so nothing would grow there, and built a Roman city called Aelia Capitolina in its place as a Greek cosmopolitan city, which was the end of anything Jewish. And all Jews were outlawed to return to the city of Jerusalem, which was no longer called Jerusalem, on pain of death. And so you could say definitely that the imagery in Revelation could refer to such a catastrophic event in the minds of the Jews. So a preterist would look at a prophecy that way, that everything has already been fulfilled in Scripture, and there is nothing left to look forward to in the future. Many commentators believe that prophecy operates on two levels, though. It was predicting events that were going to happen shortly, but it was also predicting long-term events, and so they're trying to get both things happening. If you look at Scripture, Scripture was basically written for the people who were going to read it of that time. The imagery, the intent, the focus was on the people that the writer was living with. It was for the people of his day. But these commentators would say, but God was also downloading information that was going to have relevance in the far future for us. And so that is another point of view that you'll need to deal with. All of these different points of view that we've tried to lay out here and all the ways that we have to categorize what it is that we believe make an obvious question come to mind. And that's it. That is, how do we know that we're right? How do we know what we really have here? Has anyone really figured this whole thing out? And from such basic things as to whether there is or is not a rapture, whether these prophecies have already been fulfilled or not, let alone whether we actually have the imagery right. Are we supposed to take this stuff literally, or are we supposed to take it figuratively? All these big questions need to be answered before you can even jump on the task of trying to figure out what this sequence looks like, and if we can really match up the books of Scripture to the headlines in the newspaper. Well, there's two things that I want to do. First of all, if nothing else, after having heard all of this, I don't expect you to be able to repeat it. I don't expect you to know it. All I want you to be able to take away from today is that it is all controversial, it is all debatable, and it is all highly speculative, at the very best, at the very least. Okay, so just know that. I think the most dangerous position to take on any of this is that you really know exactly what's going to happen. That's the most dangerous position to take, because we just really can't. And the second thing that I would like to get across this morning is, what priority do we give it? Where do we place it in our life? And what attitude should we have toward the times that we're living in? And one of the things that I like to do is look at the relative amount of time that the scriptural books take to discuss certain issues as some sort of guide to our priority. You know, one of the things that Jesus talks about most is money in his teaching, because that is a very important thing for us to try to deal with in our lives. Other things that he doesn't deal with at all or deals with seldomly, well, that sort of gives you an idea of priority. There are 89 chapters in the four Gospels. Do you know how many deal with prophetic events? Four. That's 4.5%. I worked it out. I think that's a pretty good percentage of the amount of brain time and heart time that we should give to prophecy. About 4.5%. And if you took the whole Bible, you basically are dealing with the books that we just talked about, Ezekiel and Daniel, and a couple of chapters out of Matthew and Luke, and Revelation, and some scattered verses throughout the rest of the books. You probably would come up to about the same percentage, somewhere around 5%. If that's a priority that God gives in His Word, then I think that's a good priority for us to have. For us to be so predominantly focused on prophecy and end times is a mismanagement of what God has given us to do. Now, one thing that I really want you guys to think about is context. We're always talking about context. It's really important to establishing what Jesus is talking about. And I want to direct your attention to three spots in the Gospels right now, just so you can see how context works. Matthew 24, if you got your books and you want to go there, fine. If not, just go ahead and take a listen. But at the beginning of chapter 24 of Matthew, this is the end times chapter that, as it's interpreted most often, where Jesus speaks about such issues. But look at what happens right at the beginning of chapter 24. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Then, now as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, his disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us when these things will be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age." So basically, both things are being established as context, possibly. Jesus has already set the context. He's talking about the temple being destroyed. And then they come and ask him, "Tell us when these things are going to happen, and the sign of your coming and the end of the age." This gives the idea that both things are going to take place, that Jesus is going to talk about the immediate and the far-reaching. The disciples asked him, "When will all these things be, and what will be the signs of your coming and the end of the age?" We can read the end of the age being our age, but they would ask the end of the age being their age. The end of the age very much ended for Israel when the temple went down. That was the end of their age. And then he goes through the whole rest of the chapter is dealing with all these horrible events that are going to take place. And when you get all the way to verse 36, he says something really interesting. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So Jesus is basically saying he doesn't even know when that time is going to be, but only the angels and the Father. Hold your finger in Matthew and go to Luke 21. Look at Luke 21:5 right now, because the context is much more specific in Luke. Then as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, "These things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." So they asked him, saying, "Teacher, but when will these things be, and what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?" And he said, and then he goes into another long monologue using almost identical imagery to the chapter in Matthew. But the context here is very specific. The disciples are asking him, when will these things be, in reference and in context to the destruction of the temple? And so the most literal thing that you can do is place those two side by side and saying the context is the destruction of the temple. That everything Jesus is talking about is referring to the destruction of the temple. And when they ask him about when is the end of the age, they're talking about the age in which they live, and not about some far-off age that they know nothing about. And so once again, trying to get the idea of context is really important. Obviously, that's much more difficult to do in a book like Revelation, and less so, or a little bit more so in Daniel and Ezekiel. But here, it seems pretty clear that you can take a preterist point of view and be on fairly firm ground, that you don't have to say that these are also simultaneously dealing with events in the far future. Now, in Matthew 24 is that passage where two will be working side by side, one will be taken and one will be left, which is used as an allusion toward the rapture. But if now we're placing the context in the first Jewish war around 70 AD, well, then we're going to have to rethink what that actually means, because it can't refer to that if it's placed in that context. Context is everything. You have to establish context before you can know what's going on. This is a basic hermeneutic principle. So if we establish the context to be Jesus is predicting the end of Jerusalem and the temple, then everything within this passage would need to be interpreted within that context. Exactly. So we have to try to understand that within that framework and not a longer framework. Now, a lot of preterists are, there's full preterists and there's semi-preterists. Almost every one of these concepts breaks down. I know. Full preterists say that everything was fulfilled in the short time frame. A semi-preterist would say that most of it was, but Jesus will still come again physically at the end of the age. So that would be a semi-preterist. So there's all these different permutations. Now, if you take that imagery and then you tack it on to, remember the story about the wedding banquet where there are 10 virgins who are waiting for the groom to return. This is Matthew 25. And 5 are wise and 5 are foolish. And the foolish ones don't make sure that they have oil in their lamps. So when the word comes out that the groom is coming to take his bride, the ones who don't have any oil are caught unawares. And when they go off to buy the oil, then by the time they come back, the doors are shut, and they can't get in, and they're left in the outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. That imagery is connected with the imagery in chapter 24, to saying we need to be ready, because when the end time comes, we're going to be caught unawares. But I want you to read with me, right at the top of Matthew 25, "Then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish," and so on and so forth. What is the context there? The kingdom of heaven. The context clearly in chapter 24 and Luke 21 were about when the temple was going to be destroyed. The context here is something entirely different. What is the prerequisite, or what is the kingdom of heaven like? What is the prerequisite to entering the kingdom of heaven? What is it like? The context has shifted. And we know from our previous studies that the kingdom of heaven is not heaven, afterlife heaven. It is the apprehension or the quality of life that we can have right here and now in the presence of God. So Jesus is trying to tell us it's like this thing. Some of you have heard the whole Jewish betrothal and wedding customs, and some of you maybe have not. Jesus uses this imagery so much because it was probably the primary social event of any of the villages in first century Palestine, was the wedding event. It was what they looked forward to. It was like Disneyland. It was something that the entire community celebrated in, like a July 4th block party, and it was something that was really a community-wide gathering. And so the imagery of the wedding was something that Jesus used all the time to try to get his point across about the kingdom. There are actually two celebrations. The betrothal was like a mini-wedding celebration, and then you had the wedding itself. And in between the two, something had to take place. In their customs, the woman would go live with the bridegroom in his father's house. And what the bridegroom would have to do would be to add on an addition to the home that he and his wife would live in, and that was called a mansion. And so the bridegroom was responsible for, after the betrothal party, to go back to his father's house and build this addition to the home. But of course, being anxious to get this whole thing over with, there had to be a check and balance, and so the father was the one who approved the construction and told the bridegroom when it was finished to his approval, and then he could go collect his bride, bring her back, and then they would have the actual wedding celebration. Now, if you're starting to double think this with me, with the imagery that Jesus uses, he says, I go to my father's house to prepare a mansion for you. He's using the same imagery that they are already familiar with. The time of my return, you will not know. I don't even know, only my Father in heaven knows. It's the same thing. The bridegroom didn't know when his father was going to give him the okay. He couldn't tell his bride, I'll be here next Tuesday to come get you, because it wasn't up to him. It was up to his father to approve the construction. He is trying to get a point across. Remember, the context is, what is it like living in the kingdom? Now let's switch the viewpoint and look at it from the point of view of the bride. The bride goes home to her father's house and has to carry on with life as if nothing happened, and has to wait until the groom comes to get her. Now, there is no telephone. There's no telegraph. There's no cable TV. She knows when the groom is coming when someone sees him coming down the road and comes and runs and tells her the groom is on his way to come get you, and run and get ready. She needs to live in a constant state of expectation. Joyful expectation. She can't wait. She knows it's coming soon, but she doesn't know when. The groom doesn't even know. Only the father knows. But the father really, it's not like the father knows the date. The father will just know it when he sees it. And so she is living in this constant state of joyful expectation to be ready every day, that this might be the day that he comes over the rise and down the path to her house. And all of her followers with her. If you look at the apocalyptic literature, we are expecting something terrible to take place. But in the case of the kingdom, you're expecting something wonderful to come and take place. There are two different mindsets. Are we waiting for something terrible, or are we waiting for something wonderful? Not only that, there is the expectation that any moment this thing can burst in upon us, and the groom will come to be with us and take us back to the Father's house. So, the point is here is that the imagery surrounding the lamps and trimming your wicks and keeping the oil is about being ready, being in a state of expectancy day by day. Jesus also says in the other context, in Matthew 24, watch and see these signs. And when you see this and such happen, he says, flee to the mountains. But that literally happened. When the armies of Rome were marching on Jerusalem, the Jewish Christians fled to Perea, which is an area of across the Transjordan, and stayed there until the war was over. And they raised the ire of the rest of the Jews, who thought that they were traitors, and they ran out on them. But they were heeding the words of Yeshua and left when these things came. But again, different context. So does that mean that we're supposed to watch and wait and watch every sign of the coming apocalypse? Or are we supposed to be taking more of an attitude of these young women and the bride? How are we supposed to live? That's really what we want to look at. Regardless of where you come down on all of this stuff, and again, I am not saying disregard it all, but what I'm saying is put it into a proper perspective. Jesus is very clear about what kingdom living is supposed to be. We talked about it last month as being upside down and downside up and backside front. It's really the opposite of everything that we think we're supposed to do. If you think about the attitude of someone who is really involved in end times literature. The typical profile of such a person is sort of the engineering type. Usually male, usually very linear thinking and very precise and analytical, and they're working out all of this stuff. And they typically it engenders a lot of fear and everything opposite to the imagery that Jesus used when he talked about the kingdom. He said, if you're going to enter the kingdom, you have to become like a little child. And the word there is talia, which means both child and house servant. So if you merge all the qualities of a child, which is wonderment and joy and total dependence and innocence, with this house servant who is humble and who is of service to everyone around him, you get the idea of the type of person that Jesus is talking about who is living in kingdom. And then if you marry that to the image of the young woman and her entourage waiting for the groom to come in this vibrant expectancy and this can't wait scenario, we're going to have this huge party and everybody's going to be there and I'm going to be with my husband. That's the kind of expectancy, moment by moment and day by day. You start to get the idea of the type or the quality of life that Jesus is talking about, which is completely antithetical to the other one. Okay, now let me kind of wrap this up and start to put it all together, because one thing I don't want to say is that I don't believe that we're heading to some sort of crisis point, because I think if you just look at all the systems of the world, I think it's pretty obvious that we are. Our civilization is so fragilely, precariously balanced right now on energy and ecology and economic systems that any one little thing, I mean, you just saw what the two towers going down did to the stock market and to the entire nation. Imagine a nuclear exchange. Imagine disruption of the flow of oil out of the Middle East. Any one thing can really change the world as we know it. Difficult times are going to come. There is no doubt about it. And so how we are prepared to deal with those difficult times when they come, if we are still here, is everything. And how do we deal with that? One of the things psychologically that I think is the pull of end times thinking is that it's a way to try to take back some control in very uncertain times. Everything is so uncertain and so scary out there right now. If we think that we know the scenario, if we think we know how it's all going to shake out, and if we think we know we're going to be airlifted out before it really gets bad, that is a comforting thought, and it's a way of trying to take back some control. And that is not about kingdom living. That's not the way, that is, again, that's an attitude that is a far afield from the talia that we just talked about. Not only that, if you are focused on end times, you are necessarily focused in the future, which means you're not focused on the present. The present is where we're supposed to be focused, not on the future. And the final thing is that we tend to always want to look outside ourselves for some sort of salvation. But Jesus told us specifically in Luke 17 that the kingdom is not going to come by observation. You're not going to be able to say, look, there it is, or here it is. The kingdom is within you, it's in your midst, it's among you. The Greek word there, entos, means all of those things at the same time. But in the Aramaic and the Syriac, it's even more specific. The phrase there is legalmen. And that literally means moving from inside to outside. And so the kingdom is literally moving from the inside to the outside. It starts in our hearts with our own awareness of God's presence. And then as more and more hearts are turned on, then it moves out into the community. This is what Jesus is talking about. Really, it's kind of like Dorothy at the end of The Wizard of Oz, where she finally says, you know, the next time I go looking for my heart's desire, I'm not going to look any further than my own backyard, because if it's not there, then I never really lost it to begin with. The hero's journey that happens throughout all of literature is like that. We think we need to go out there to find it. But what we find out is just like T.S. Eliot wrote in a poem called Little Gidding, where is at the end of all of our exploration, we come back to where we started and know the place for the first time. That's what Jesus is talking about. Our exploration is from within. It's that fifth way that we talked about. It's what happens as we turn inward and find God in our midst that is going to make the difference. Then we can live in the kingdom, as Jesus said. And then we can live not always looking for the last day, but living each day as if it were the last day, in that sense of expectation and excitement in the presence of God in our midst. I just hope that you can take all of this stuff and all this discussion and put it into a place that makes sense in your life so that you can live every day as if it were the last and suck every drop out of it. I will tell you, truthfully, as far as end times comes, I'm an agnostic. I'm very proud to say, I don't know. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know if we've got it right. And I will also say, it just doesn't matter one whit to me if I do or not. Because it is not, it doesn't have anything to do with me in terms of how I live this moment. I realize bad things could be coming. I will deal with those when that future moment becomes the present moment. And until then, and between all those moments, I hope and I pray that I will be able to live each one as it comes with a sense of God in the world.